From NPR and WBUR, I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. A massive winter storm will stretch across the country this weekend from California all the way to the Northeast. And that means more rain for California, where some towns are already flooded. The Russian River in the northern part of the state swelled to the highest level in 25 years late Wednesday. It turned the town of Guerneville into an island. A nearby weather station measured over 20 inches of rainfall in 2 days. Joining us now is Linda Hopkins, who is a supervisor for Sonoma County. Linda, thanks for joining us.
Of course.
I know you were up in the air recently surveying the damage. What did you see?
It is just so widespread. I mean, we have entire small towns along the Russian River underwater, businesses, homes, parking lots, infrastructure. We also have a number of downed trees and power lines and significant mudslides that are blocking off main arterials throughout Sonoma County.
We keep reading that several towns in the area have been turned into islands. What does that mean? Does that mean that the roads are completely impassable in some places?
Yes, so exactly. The roads are actually submerged and the community literally has no way in and no way out. So they either have to evacuate before the roads go under or they are sitting there hunkered down for sometimes days on end, often without power and just left with whatever food supplies they have on hand when the roads close.
How are those people doing? Have they needed to be rescued from the waters?
We have had about 60 rescues of people in addition to a number of pet and livestock rescues. We're very lucky that we had the National Guard here. We also had local firefighters working with state officials. We had 3 swift water teams and 4 helicopters on duty able to rescue people who were trapped.
Look, the Russian River Valley, it's prone to flooding. We're seeing there was major floods in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 80s. And in the 90s, and of course now. But you've gotten nearly 2 feet of rain in 2 days. How does that compare to what you've seen in the past?
This is definitely a generational weather event and a generational flood. You know, unfortunately, we've got a lot of people who have moved to the Russian River area since the 90s, and we haven't really had a flood this bad, as you said, in 25 years. And so for some people, this is really a wake-up call of exactly how dangerous and how large the Russian River can get.
How's your home? Do you live in the area?
I do. Unfortunately, my home is on a hill, but I was isolated. I had all of the main arterials cut off around me, and some neighbors just literally down the hill from me were flooded out entirely.
You've had so many issues in Sonoma County recently. There was the wildfires in 2017, tons of precipitation this year. How are people holding up through all of these natural disasters?
You know, I really do believe that strong communities become stronger in the event of a disaster, and Sonoma County pulls together, and I know that we will pull together to get through this flood. But, you know, it really raises another point, which is that in many ways, we now feel like we are ground zero for the impacts of climate change. Climate change modeling and predictions show that we will actually have more severe fire seasons, but then also in the winter, more severe flooding seasons. So we sort of feel like now we have 2 seasons in Sonoma County where it's either fire or flood season.
You know, you're a politician. And you can help craft some of the policies that might mitigate that. Is that what you're doing? Are you prepared?
Absolutely. You know, we've really focused on resilience and recovery, and we actually set up an entire office of recovery and resiliency after the fires that I think will come in very handy for the flooding that we're currently experiencing. But in addition to looking at how we can, for instance, elevate homes and businesses more effectively to get them out of the floodplain or reduce fire risk through home hardening and other strategies, we're also trying to look at how do we reduce our own greenhouse gas emissions here at home so that we make sure that Sonoma County isn't contributing to the international challenge of climate change and greenhouse gas emissions.
Are the waters receding now?
The waters are receding, and this morning we will be sending 60 county employees in to do property damage assessments. We're hoping that residents will be back in and allowed into the evacuated areas this afternoon.
Linda Hopkins is a supervisor for Sonoma County, California, where floodwaters from the Russian River now do appear to be receding. Linda, thank you, and good luck.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Well, the New England Patriots billionaire owner Robert Kraft pleaded not guilty this week to charges of soliciting prostitution. The charges stem from an ongoing human trafficking investigation in several South Florida counties. The United Nations reports that sexual exploitation remains the most widespread form of human trafficking around the world. We wanted to take a deeper look at trafficking related to massage parlors in the U.S. Joining us now is Meredith Dank, an expert on human trafficking at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. Meredith, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
There's still a lot we don't really know about this case with Robert Kraft and the wider trafficking investigation surrounding it. But when you first heard about the story, what were your thoughts?
My thoughts immediately went to the women who were involved in the massage parlor and what was happening to them. Were they arrested? And my understanding is they weren't. But in that case, were they receiving any kind of services or immigration relief?
What do we know about who's working in these parlors? I mean, some of the women might be immigrants and possibly have sketchy legal statuses. But from your research, what do we know about how women are recruited for these?
So the recruitment, I think, can happen in many different ways. Sometimes in their home country, oftentimes it's China or Korea or Thailand, they might be approached about a work opportunity. In some cases, people are very open about the fact that they might be working in a massage parlor and they can make the choice as to whether or not they want to do that. In other cases, they're told they would work in a restaurant or a nail salon and then they come here. And there are definitely cases where women are then forced or coerced into working in a massage parlor. But what I've often heard is that they're paying a snakehead, sometimes upwards of tens of thousands of dollars, and they have to pay that.
A trafficker, ahead of a trafficker.
Yes. And they have to pay that debt back. Mm-hmm. And so they come here, they might start working in a restaurant or a nail salon and not make much money. And as a result, they have to look for other ways in which they can do that and fly under the radar, especially if they're not on a legal visa.
Well, we know that these illicit massage businesses have existed in the U.S. for a long time, and they're often fronts for prostitution. But how much do we really know about these parlors and how they operate, the whole thing?
We don't know much. There hasn't been a ton of research that's been done to date. I've done a little bit of research in interviewing law enforcement about what they've been seeing, particularly trends over time. And there definitely has been a proliferation of these massage parlors, particularly in the Midwest and in the South. However, the actual operation of the massage parlors is still very much a big question. You know, who is operating them? Is there a larger organization behind it? Or is it tend to be just mom and pop type of massage parlors where somebody opens it up? They might have networks with other massage parlors across the country, but there isn't one single person behind it.
And so we don't know a lot about the larger potential global trafficking chain behind that as well.
Correct.
And is that because there's reluctance to talk, that researchers are having trouble getting access, or what?
I think that is definitely a big piece is, you know, who would we speak to other than law enforcement, which can provide, I think, one point of view. Mm. But what's really important to be able to understand the true dynamics of this, of these parlors and the operation is to be able to talk to the people working with inside of them, which is where I think we would really begin to understand whether or not there's actual sex trafficking happening. I think that's something law enforcement has really struggled with finding evidence for. In the case of the Robert Kraft situation, you know, some of the details I saw, it kind of was more about labor trafficking, the fact that they were living in the place that they were working, that the living conditions were pretty subpar. These are all signs of actual labor trafficking, not necessarily sex trafficking. So I think there's still a lot we need to learn to even begin to get the nuance of this problem.
I want to get your response to some tape from the Martin County, Florida Sheriff's Office that opened this investigation. Sheriff William Snyder spoke earlier this week with our colleagues at All Things Considered. He said, you know, one of the reasons sex trafficking continues today is because many of the women working in these businesses just don't want to cooperate with law enforcement.
Invariably, our methodology has been, up until we did this here, we'll send a couple of undercover detectives in. They'll, you know, be solicited for sex. We'll arrest the workers and shut the place down, and the problem goes away, but not really goes away. And so when this came in, I made the decision that we would treat this differently and that we would go after the traffickers and the men, the end users.
Meredith, what do you think about the sheriff's strategy of going after the Johns and potentially the larger traffickers?
Well, first of all, I think we need to determine whether or not there's actual sex trafficking happening here or if it's exploitation, gender-based violence, that sort of thing. But let's say there is a trafficker behind that. I think that is a good strategy is to try and determine who that might be. In some cases, the massage parlor, the person that you would get access to is the middle manager, not necessarily the person who owns it or the person who's operating it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important that we really begin to understand, again, the structure of the of how a massage parlor works. And then as far as the Johns go and targeting them, I think there's a lot of issues that can come up if you're just solely focusing on the demand side of things. It doesn't necessarily get rid of the issue that these women are coming in here and looking for ways in order to pay that debt back. And there are very few options available to them. That doesn't mean that working in a massage parlor should be the only option. But I think we really need to be creative and think about how we can help these women in order to provide opportunities for women who don't want to be doing this and are constrained in the choices available to them to be able to pay back this debt or pay for whatever other kind of debt that they might have is really, I think, the angle we should be taking.
Meredith Dank is an expert on human trafficking and a research professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. Meredith, thanks so much.
Thank you.
YouTube said yesterday that it's disabling comments on most videos featuring children, after a video blogger recently showed how alleged pedophiles have been taking advantage of the comments section to post sexually explicit messages. It's just one of the social media stories we're following this week with Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. So let's bring her in. Femi, hi.
Hello there, Peter. Hi.
Good. So, you know, YouTube says you can't comment on videos with kids any longer, younger than 13. It seems like a huge task to undertake because users upload 400 hours of content a minute on YouTube. So how do you do it? How do you know if a kid even meets that threshold?
Well, there are a couple of things YouTube is doing, and they announced this on Thursday, that they describe this as critical steps to keep young people safe on YouTube. So the disabling of the comments, any video that has minors in it, unless you have a special request, the comments will be disabled. And your special request has to go through to YouTube. They will look at it and you have to moderate the comments. They can't just be there. You have to be there in the chat room and moderate them. They also have, to answer your question, Peter, about how do they do it, a comment classifier that is going to be even more aggressive than the ones that they're using right now. And that will be looking out for predatory comments. And they will be removing all material that the people feel and that YouTube feel is endangering children. And that's where they're enlisting our help. Any of the users on YouTube, anybody watching YouTube, if you see something, flag that content. So they need the help of people using YouTube as well as their own team.
Okay. And it sounds like a lot of people on social media are saying, thanks, YouTube, but why aren't you doing more about all the other problems on your site?
Exactly. So there's a whole list of, well, what about the content and monetizing content? And then Daddy Daughter Gamer commented on YouTube's own Twitter site saying, why don't you just try punishing the people making these bad comments and not the creators?
Okay, sticking with this idea of watching out for the safety of kids online, I want to talk about this viral hoax that seems to be popping up again. It's the Momo Challenge, where this creepy-looking bird woman creature is stalking the internet.
It's a telling scary monster lady.
Tell kids to harm themselves. But this is not even a real thing, as far as we can tell. So what's going on, and why are people talking about it?
Parents are panicking. Kids and youngsters are panicking as well, because you can imagine you're watching YouTube, back at YouTube again, and then a kid's video or a cartoon, and then up pops this scary, creepy woman known as Momo. And it's really a scare tactic. It's hoaxers doing it. It's scammers doing it. But and this scary woman pops up. She will tell you to do bad things, maybe attack somebody, do something bad around the house. And parents got really scared that this was a real thing. And it's really people who have the tech knowledge pranking everybody. It's got to the stage now where police around the world have been investigating and to work out what is happening. Is this a real thing? And they found no real evidence tying these requests for a weird challenge to do bad things to an actual person or a team of people, other than random people being very mischievous. I like what the Northern Ireland police said as they were given a warning out on Facebook. And they said, as creepy as she looks, Momo isn't going to crawl out of your child's phone and kill them. This is merely a current attention-grabbing example of the minefield that is online communication for kids. That's a great post by the Northern Ireland police. And really, for parents, it's not real. It is people scamming you and hoaxing the kids. Kids, I know it looks scary. It's not real either. Ignore it.
It's not real, but boy, are people talking about it, including kids at school. I know that. Another thing that we are watching, Walmart announcing it's going to replace its greeters with customer hosts. People are saying, what about all the people with disabilities who rely on those jobs at Walmart?
Yeah, so many people who are the greeters are people with disabilities. They may have special needs. They may be seniors. And people who shop at Walmart are really upset about that. Suzanne is saying on Twitter, this is so wrong. They're doing it to save money and reduce liability. And then Ryan says, I'm sorry to hear you're eliminating the greeter position at Walmart, at all of your stores for us customers. The greeters are one of the true bright spots of the trip to your stores. Walmart says they're transitioning people and hoping to place people who are greeters in other posts and positions around their stores.
Lastly, but quickly, pop star Ariana Grande having a very good week. She's number one on the Billboard Top 100 with seven rings. She's now the queen
of
Instagram.
At number one.
5 weeks.
Absolutely. Yes, Ariana Grande is now the most followed woman on Instagram.
Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thank you.
You're so welcome.
Well, television's mid-season is upon us, and with it, a whole bunch of new shows. Traditionally, networks would debut their most experimental concepts in March and April, but now it seems this period has become nearly as competitive as the fall season. NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans joins us to talk about the new offerings. Hey, Eric.
Hey.
Well, let's talk about some of them. Both ABC and NBC have spy dramas. ABC's Whiskey Cavalier focuses on a budding partnership between an FBI and a CIA agent. Let's take a listen.
I want to thank you for stopping a grievous threat to our great country. Of course, officially, none of it ever occurred.
I'm sorry, are you saying you're just going to sweep all this under the rug?
That's not what he said. You need to listen more.
Don't tell me what I need to do.
We're not sweeping it under the rug.
See?
I have a new assignment for you.
Meanwhile, NBC's The Enemy Within is about a convicted traitor who's re-enlisted by the government to try to root out a conspiracy.
These are highly trained, deadly operatives in every city and every state, hiding in plain sight as teachers, engineers, husbands and wives, ticking time bombs. This is not random. This is a coordinated effort.
Eric, both these shows focus on intelligence agencies, though Whiskey Cavalier sounds a lot more lighthearted than The Enemy Within. Tell us about these shows.
So Whiskey Cavalier was pretty anticipated, actually. It's a series featuring Lauren Cohan, who people might remember from The Walking Dead. And it also features Scott Foley, who was on Scandal. And they play these two sort of operatives who are pitted against each other. They have this rivalry, but of course there's this will they, won't they chemistry, you know? And it's lighthearted. And Lauren Cohan's character is way better than Scott Foley's character. Hmm. The Enemy Within is a much more serious show featuring Jennifer Carpenter. People may remember her from the series Dexter. She played his sister. And now she plays this woman who is a trusted leader in the CIA who winds up working for the other side, betraying her comrades. But there's more to the story. Mm. And Morris Chestnut plays a straight-laced official who has to bring her in to help solve an important case. So both of these are attempts to kind of bring an espionage thriller to network television. I think in both cases, they're not quite as clever and as complex as they think they are. So these shows are trying hard, but I think there's a reason why we're seeing them debut at this time of the year.
In the mid-seasons, yeah. Finally, Fox is taking another stab at game shows. They're premiering a new one called Mental Samurai. It's hosted by Rob Lowe, and as I understand it, has contestants answer questions while being flung about by a giant rotating capsule. How does this one add up for you, Eric?
Yeah, you know, when you think of Mensa candidates, you think of Rob Lowe. No, no, I'm just kidding. This show features people who have to answer a set of questions within 5 minutes, and they just happen to be seated inside a globe that whips around this huge studio.
Oh, my God.
And so they answer one question in front of a screen, and they get whipped around to the other one. And so it's an attempt to sort of disorient them while also asking them questions that seem simple on their face but might actually require a little more thought. Hmm. It's amusement park Dark Ride meets TV game show. Wow. It hasn't debuted yet, so I'm not sure if it's any good, but it doesn't. I'm not placing any bets.
Wow. That sounds bizarre. Another one that is bizarre, but is an undisputed hit so far. Fox's The Masked Singer, a competition show where elaborately disguised contestants, people dressed up as rabbits or birds and such, perform in front of judges who try to guess their identity. Let's hear the final number of the season winner. This is how we do it. This is how we do it. La, 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 la. This is how we do it. Who is he? This is
Martin how Lawrence, we do maybe? It. It's Friday night, and I feel all right. The party's here on the west side.
Yeah, for listeners, that's being sung by a furry one-eyed monster on a neon stage. Eric, how did The Masked Singer become such a big hit?
Oh, I don't know. Did someone slip something into the water for you know, millions of viewers? I don't know. I just think it's that idea that it's something so unusual that it breaks through the clutter. Mm. So to have a show that's so distinctly unique based on a concept from overseas, I think it just struck a chord with people. Mm. You know, it does remind me a little bit of some of the TV shows they show in these dystopian movies like RoboCop when people have kind of given up on pop culture. So I'm not sure that it's a great sign that The Masked Singer is a huge hit, but I'm sure we're going to see more attempts to tap into whatever this thing is tapping into.
Yeah, it kind of feels like if The Gong Show and RoboCop had a baby in Korea or something, it might look like The Masked Singer.
It might be The Masked Singer followed by Mental Samurai.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, who, as far as we know, is not dressed up in a furry costume singing right now. Thank you for joining us.
You don't know that.
Well, you could be. It's true. This is how we do it.
This is how I do it, anyway.
Thanks, Eric.
Always a pleasure.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
Every week, tens of thousands of Americans complete drug and alcohol rehab programs. But the months that follow are often fraught with risk. A treatment counselor won't be there for support around the clock. But a smartphone can be. Tom Bonsi of the Northwest News Network reports on a growing digital support network.
Daniela Tudor knows how hard it is to break a habit because she's been there. The self-described serial entrepreneur used alcohol and cocaine while working on a music industry startup earlier this decade. Trying to quit without help didn't work.
So I tried everything from just basically trying to control it on my own, going to yoga retreats, eating differently, changing my surroundings.
She eventually landed at an inpatient drug and alcohol treatment center. That's where the idea for her next startup hit.
I journaled about it and I thought about how can we use, you know, our phones who are with us 24/7 to bridge the two things that support recovery, accountability to your care plan and connection to your support network in real time.
Tudor later described her idea to another person in recovery, former French Open tennis doubles champion Murphy Jensen. Jensen agreed to co-found the startup We Connect Health with Tudor in Seattle in 2015. He became a beta tester for an addiction recovery app, as well as executive VP of the new company.
It's my lifeline. I, on a daily basis, and you know, not only the technology, but the interface, it gives me warm, loving messages and reminders to stay on track. It keeps me connected to the key stakeholders in my life.
Jensen knows from personal experience that the relapse rate for people in recovery is shockingly high. WeConnect sells its app to treatment centers and insurance companies, who in turn install it on clients' phones when they're sent home.
And so you set up your profile.
Tudor pulls out her own smartphone to demonstrate a reward feature to prevent relapses.
So here it tells you at the top the challenge you're on. You can earn up to, on this challenge, $20 by checking into 5 support routines, 13 self-care routines, and you have 5 days left.
You're getting there. Mm-hmm. And you're going to get, what, $20 in gift card?
This is an Amazon gift card.
Oh, that's kind of nice. I take that.
Yes.
The location tracking ability of smartphones can confirm if patients are attending scheduled doctor and court appointments, 12-step meetings, urinalysis tests. If the client begins slipping, the software automatically sends an alert to the treatment provider and any other supporters the patient pre-selects. Dr. Dennis Donovan at the University of Washington says few of the dozen or so addiction recovery apps have been independently tested for efficacy, but he foresees situations where they may be very useful.
Apps like this can also provide an opportunity to develop social support networks. Many people may find it difficult or they don't choose to attend things like Alcoholics Anonymous, but can benefit from a social system or a social network that can enhance and provide support for their recovery process.
Donovan says smartphone apps won't be the end-all cure-all, but may work well as a complement to other treatment. WeConnect Health CEO Tudor says her goal is not to replace human counselors, it's to cut the relapse rate in half.
In this field, the incredible thing is that, you know, even moving the needle by 5% on the recovery rate means millions of lives. It means billions of dollars in cost savings.
For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonsi in Seattle.
Across the world, coastal cities are at risk from storm surges and rising seas related to climate change. One report estimates that more than 300,000 coastal homes in the U.S. alone, with a collective market value of some $118 billion, are at risk of chronic flooding within the next 30 years. Some states have also seen deadly, catastrophic wildfires and drought related to climate change. We wanted to know what cities are doing now to better protect people and property. We reached out to two experts. Susie Torriente is the Chief Resilience Officer and Assistant City Manager for Miami Beach, and Rachel Cletus is Policy Director for Climate and Energy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. I started by asking Susie Torriente in Miami Beach, among the places most vulnerable to sea level rise, what the city's doing now to try to mitigate that risk.
It's important to start understanding your risk, understanding the science. And that's exactly what we're doing here in South Florida through the Southeast Florida Climate Compact. Over the last 10 years, we have been sharing information and collaborating and developing regional tools so that cities like Miami Beach can start to adapt to climate change and invest in our aging infrastructure. So Miami Beach is dealing with this in a couple of different ways. You may have seen our stormwater pumps and our elevated roads, and we've been investing in our seawalls, our public seawalls. And that's actually very visible and very prominent. So when we realized that we were experiencing these sunny day flooding and we were experiencing these high tides, we, as a city and a city commission and the residents, decided to make the changes and to adapt. So we have a 10-year, about $600 million stormwater program. But in addition to that, we're looking at our land use code and zoning, and for all new development, we're requiring development to be built higher than the FEMA-based flood. We're actually going to a foot to 5 feet of freeboard. So we're making those kinds of changes so that we can adapt and invest in our private stock of buildings as well.
And for some streets, you're literally raising the roads up?
Absolutely. In some areas of the city where we're lower lying, more vulnerable, and that's on the west side of the island, some roads are being raised. The most pronounced is maybe at about 2 feet. In other parts in the area, it could just be sloping up just a little bit as we replace our aging stormwater pipes and our gravity system to this pump-based system.
Susie, voters have approved new funds for climate resilience, some $200 million from a recent ballot measure. But what kind of pushback, if any, have you gotten from residents who might worry that this is an overreaction or an overreach?
Well, the voters approved that really overwhelmingly. And I think because the city had a very good and strong outreach and education campaign, and we had a very public vetting of all the different projects. Where there we have gotten pushbacks is as we go into specific neighborhoods and as we start to design a particular road, we do get questions from individual homeowners because they want to understand, you know, how is this going to affect the look and feel of my house and my yard and my entry, and how will these projects affect flooding on private property? So as we're going into the different communities, we are talking to individual residents. We are easing those tensions that people feel when you're talking about probably one of their most important assets, their home.
Well, speaking of that most important asset, as I understand it, most of the seawalls are on private property, the majority anyway. What kind of carrot do you have for private property owners to try to convince them, hey, you've got to take action here?
One of our key messages is that we're in this together. And as we start to make investments in the public realm, we do encourage business owners and residents to, you know, start looking at their property, understand their elevation, understand what they need to do to reduce their own risk. And for seawalls, we actually do have criteria that's adopted by City Commission on the height of the seawalls, looking towards the future to help protect themselves.
And Rachel Cletus at the Union of Concerned Scientists, to you, I mean, you're trying to convince the public to change and to take some fundamental action. At the same time, you know, cities don't want to alienate businesses, developers, and investors that they have to work with and that they want to invest in jobs and infrastructure. But how do you raise alarm and win hearts and minds without seeming alarmist?
Well, here's the reality. We still have time and our choices matter greatly. And I think that's the conversation that we want to invite with a wide range of stakeholders, including folks whose homes are at risk, as Susie just pointed out, because just giving people bad news is not enough. We really have to create the space for solutions, for options, for the what next piece of this. It's a huge challenge, no doubt. But we need to move through this together as a nation. And I think the starting point for these conversations is the fact that this is not news to people on the front lines of this risk. They're seeing the flooding. They're seeing the wildfires, the droughts, the extreme heat. So it's about bringing solutions into those places.
I just couldn't agree more. You don't scare people into action. I think you inform people so that they can start to understand and manage the risk. And that's exactly the approach we're taking here in Miami Beach and in South Florida. And what we're doing here needs to be replicated throughout the country.
Former UN Chief Ban Ki-moon recently warned that the current efforts to protect coastal cities are falling far short, that the world's biggest economies invested $25 billion on adaptation in 2014, but lost many, many times that to floods, droughts, storms, and wildfires. What do you think is needed to get policymakers and mayors to invest more?
Well, I think the first most important thing is to understand the science and the risks that are coming our way very clearly. And we've seen two authoritative reports in the last year, one from the IPCC and one from the U.S. federal agency's fourth National Climate Assessment, sort of lay out that science very clearly, both the fact that the impacts are already here and now, and that if we fail to take concerted action to limit our carbon emissions, these impacts are going to grow exponentially. So that's a really important starting point, understanding the risk and the time frames that we have available to help address these risks. We need to act, and we need to act quickly. The U.S. hasn't done enough yet at the federal level. Local elected officials are taking notice and are trying to do things, but it's happening in a very patchwork way right now. We need federal leadership so that the resources are available to all communities. We've also got to make sure that we are sharing the tools and resources that communities need, first of all, to understand the risk and what their options are to help mitigate against that risk.
Susie in Miami Beach, is climate change proofing, attracting, or repelling investors and businesses from these vulnerable cities?
I think it's attracting. I mean, I was just talking to the Greater Miami Chamber this morning, and, you know, their approach to the challenges of climate change, it's really opportunities for businesses to be innovative and to invest. And so you can drive around Miami Beach, you see new construction, you see sales of real estate continuing to break records. So I do think, again, that it's a risk that's out there, but our eyes are open to it and we're doing something about it.
Susie, what's your biggest challenge when you're trying to convince folks to take action?
I think the biggest challenge was alluded to a little earlier, that action is happening at a very local level, and we do need other partners at the state and the federal level. Miami Beach is fortunate, and we have a healthy tax base, and we have residents and elected officials that are willing to take on additional debt. But maybe other smaller cities, maybe they don't have that same tax base, and they could benefit from more resources at another level.
And Rachel, to you, you've seen how cities in both red and blue states are dealing with this and trying to be proactive in mitigating risks of climate change. Is it becoming less political?
Look, climate impacts don't distinguish between red states and blue states. They're unfolding all around our country right now, as the National Climate Assessment just highlighted. And that means that people all around the country are looking for solutions, whether they call it climate change or they call it high tide flooding. They're looking at the same problem and they're trying to find solutions. And that's the real opportunity here. We do need federal leadership, though. We need more resources. Many places just don't have the funding to come up with the resources they need to solve this problem. And we also have a real danger here of some very inequitable outcomes, where communities of color, disadvantaged communities, end up bearing the disproportionate brunt of these impacts. So we've got to make sure that we're not just harnessing federal resources, but that we're targeting them to communities in an equitable way so that people don't get left behind.
Rachel Cletus is Policy Director for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Susie Torriente is Chief Resilience Officer and Assistant City Manager for the City of Miami Beach. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
A high-stakes patent battle has been playing out in federal court in Boston. The case involves a revolutionary new type of cancer treatment that unleashes the body's own immune system. It's called immunotherapy, and it could be the most promising advance against cancer in decades. The patents on the science behind it could be worth billions of dollars. Kerry Goldberg from member station WBUR reports.
It's a legal clash between giants. Giants of science, that is. On one side is Dr. Tasuku Honjo from Kyoto University, a 77-year-old researcher who just shared in a Nobel Prize for his work on immunotherapy. In his Nobel lecture this December, he said he hopes that immunotherapy will one day transform cancer treatment, the way antibiotics have transformed treatments for infections.
Cancer may not completely disappear, but be controlled by immunotherapy. Cancer may become one of the chronic diseases. If you still have a tumor, but no growth, that's okay.
On the other side is Dana-Farber Cancer Institute researcher Dr. Gordon Freeman, a Harvard Medical School professor and immunotherapy pioneer, who's won major prizes himself, though not the Nobel. In a recent interview, unconnected to the trial, he describes the current excitement around immunotherapy.
Everyone wants to work in the area because it's so important. Really, the best and the brightest scientists and the most innovative cutting-edge technologies are being applied to the problems of immunotherapy.
That's now. But the focus of the lawsuit is nearly 20 years ago, when some of the basic science that led to immunotherapy was done. At the center of the case are a half dozen key patents that list Honjo and Japanese colleagues as inventors, but not Freeman and another American colleague. Dana-Farber, the plaintiff in the suit, is arguing that the Americans should be included on those patents, that they made significant contributions. Dr. Honjo's side includes the pharma giant Bristol-Myers Squibb, which now holds the licenses that control use of those patents. Honjo argues that no, he got no significant help from his American colleagues. One thing is sure, the stakes are high.
The patents that are currently issued to Professor Honjo are probably worth billions of dollars.
Professor Jake Shirko at New York Law School is a leading expert on patent disputes in the life sciences. He says the patents at issue here cover several immunotherapy drugs that are each selling for a couple of billion dollars a year.
We've got Keytruda, we've got Opdivo, we've got Libtayo, we've got Tecentriq, we've got Bavencio, we've got Imfinzi. All of these drugs are, if not blockbuster drugs, at least pretty close to it. So that's what this dispute is all about.
Except this case is not only about money, Shurko says, and it's an unusually ugly fight related to Nobel Prize-winning work.
It goes directly towards issues of scientific credit, honesty, and reliability. So those things combined, if you add money to the mix, it makes a particularly potent poison.
The story begins back in the early 90s, when Dr. Hanjo discovered a molecule called PD-1 on the surface of immune cells called T cells. In late 1999, Hanjo started working with Freeman at Dana-Farber and another scientist at a Cambridge biotech company on a related molecule the two Americans had discovered. It's called PD-L1. PD-1 and PD-L1 work together, Freeman explains with a metaphor.
Well, think of PD-L1 as your foot pushing down on the brake pedal. PD-1 is the brake pedal.
Cancer can take advantage of those brakes to protect itself against immune attack. To outwit it, immunotherapy uses antibodies that lift your foot, so to speak, so it can't press the brake that would protect the tumor from attack. Immunotherapy drugs that use this PD-1 pathway are now prescribed against many types of cancers, including lung cancer, and they're being tested in many combinations as well. The legal crux of the lawsuit is how significant the American side's contributions were to the work that led to the patents. It's the sort of dispute we can expect to see more of, says Dr. Jeffrey Flyer, the former dean of Harvard Medical School.
Modern science involves collaboration across laboratories, across scientific disciplines, and many end up involving the collaboration with industry as well.
Flyer researches and writes about credit in science.
So the complexity of the scientific papers that come out and the patents and the credit that results is far, far greater than it used to be.
And the financial stakes are higher, which is why legal and industry analysts have been among the spectators watching this battle royale play out. It's expected to be months before a decision is issued on the case. Given the amount of money at stake, whatever the outcome is, it's likely to be appealed. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
And it is Friday, the end of the week. It means it's time to say goodbye to our pal, Eric Westervelt, who's been co-hosting with us this week. Eric, we hear all of your reporting on all the NPR shows, but we think you sound the best on this NPR show. So thanks very much for coming to join us.
Well, I wouldn't sound good without all the great staff here at Here and Now. So thanks again for having me. It was great as usual.
All right. Thank you very much. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now.